Thank you, Jim. It's good to have you back up here again. Seems like a long time. So we've been working on the story of the Exodus and how God made a promise to Abraham and how that promise was fulfilled over thousands of years and ultimately with the coming of Jesus. And we're on part 30. The title for this morning is The Story, Part 30, Obey the Right King. So, Part 30, Obey the Right King. So, two episodes ago, we were looking at how the Israelites crossed the Jordan River and what all that symbolized for them. And also for us, we looked at how that applies to us. And then last time, we looked at how the Israelites, or what the Israelites did after they crossed the Jordan River. And there was a lot more there than I realized. When I started digging into it, but one of the main accounts there that we looked at was when the commander of the armies of the Lord comes to Joshua, and that was probably actually Jesus, from what we can tell, and how he appears to Joshua and how Joshua asks him a question, and we looked at how that question was the wrong question. Joshua asked him if the commander of the Lord's armies was on their side, on the Israelites' side, or if he was for the people of Jericho. And the commander says, neither, I'm the commander of the Lord's armies. So the question is not whether God is on our side or on our enemy's side. The question is, are we on God's side? So today we're actually going to get into the story of Jericho and how God conquered that city through the Israelites. And this is a great story, and I was fairly excited to dig into it, but when I sat down to try to get an outline together and start studying for it, I really kind of struggled with it because it's such a, I guess, well-known story. You know, almost every children's storybook Bible has all the pictures. And, you know, we've seen that I guess, the classic picture. I'll just throw it up here. You know, that the whole idea of the army being all happy because the walls are falling down, and or maybe something more like this where they're shouting. And there's even a VeggieTales movie. I don't know if you've seen this one. But it really made it hard to study this seriously because it's become such a cliche almost. So you don't have to look at that the rest of the time. I'll turn it off. It's such a well-known story that it, like I said, it's almost a cliche. It's part of even the little phrases we use, at least in English. There's, you know, lots of children's songs about it. We already looked at the VeggieTale movies, or movie. The walls of Jericho have kind of become a symbol used by, you know, Christian motivational speakers or internet preachers, whatever, to represent anything you want it to represent. It can be your cranky boss or your truck breaking down or whatever. God's going to conquer that wall for you. And I think we're kind of missing the point when that's how we look at it. Now, there's obviously some big important lessons that relate to faith and trust in God that are obvious lessons that we can learn from that and I think are good. But I think it's not right to necessarily compare, you know, that cranky boss that you might have or the tough things you might be facing in your everyday life right now. I don't think it's quite right to compare that to God collapsing and completely destroying an entire city. Especially when that city is a fortified, walled city that was the most powerful in the country. And I think the other thing we have to remember is that these stories that we were looking at in the Old Testament, they always mean something deeper than just the initial story. They're always pointing forward to something else or pointing backward or sometimes both. So there's always deeper meaning there. The question is, how do we figure that out? How do we dig into it to find that? And sometimes it means digging a little bit deeper than just the front of the story or what we're looking at. It takes maybe looking at it with a bit of a new set of eyes. So that being said, I have three goals for us today. The first one is to put ourselves into the story and imagine what it was actually like. Second one is to figure out if these points, if this does point forward to something else that will happen in the future. And if so, what is that thing? And then number three is learn how we can apply those lessons to our own lives. So if you want to turn to Joshua 6, that's where we're going to be this morning. And this is a fairly long account, especially with the whole taking of, or the, yeah, what happens after the walls fall down and getting Rahab and her family out and all that. So we're not actually going to read all of that quite. I think we're going to go down through verse 21. So I'll just read Joshua 6, verse 1 through 21. It says, Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horns, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." And he said to the people, "Go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord." And just as Joshua had commanded, the people and the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the ark, while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, "You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout." So he caused the ark of the Lord to circle the city, going about it once, and they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord walked on, and they blew the trumpets continually. And the armed men were walking before them, and the rear guard were walking after the ark of the Lord, while the trumpets blew continually. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned into the camp. So they did for 6 days. On the seventh day they rose early at the dawn of day and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times. And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver and gold and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys with the edge of the sword. So, that's a lot to digest. I don't think we're going to be able to really dig into every aspect of this, and that's not really what I'm going to try to do this morning. But I did want to point out a couple things in verse 1 there. Before we just kind of look at the whole story as one thing. It says the first thing we see here is that the people of Jericho were ready and they were scared, apparently. It says that the city was shut up inside and out. And I'm not exactly sure what that means. Obviously, being shut outside means the gates were closed. No one was going in or out. But shut in the inside is a little trickier, right? It could mean that no one was moving around in the city. Maybe they were all staying in their houses because of how afraid they were. Or maybe there was like an army fort or something there that they were all kind of hunkered in. Anyway, it says that it was shut up inside and out. I did a little bit of looking into kind of what the city would have looked like. And there's been recently, actually just the last couple years, I think, there's been a bunch of archaeology done on the site where the city of Jericho was. And up until that point, there was a lot of questions in historians' minds as to whether this account was actually true. You know, did the city actually fall down? Because it hadn't really been found yet. They didn't really think it lined up with what had been found. But this new discovery in archaeology basically confirmed everything exactly as it was. It's in the right time period. There's obvious destruction. I mean, it would look like a city would look if there were a giant earthquake and the whole thing was just flattened pretty much. But it also gave us a bunch of clues as to what the city looked like. And I'll just throw up a picture here of kind of a rendering of what they kind of think it would have looked like. You see that there's double walls there, and that was for a reason. Now, it may have grown out of the city expanding at one point, but it also served a purpose for protection because the first set of walls there, or the first wall, would have been maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. Let me continue with my notes here just a bit. So we'll look at maybe just another comment on the closed inside. It could have meant that inner wall was also closed because the outside section there would have been more of where the food would have been and where they would have maybe kept animals. So it's possible that both of those were closed up as an additional protection. Anyway, but in some ways, the fact that the city of Jericho wasn't coming out to fight with the Israelites was a good thing for them. You remember last time we looked at how that the Israelites crossed the Jordan right in front of Jericho. God could have taken them across anywhere else. He chose to take them right across at the most fortified place of the whole country, or area at least, the land. And so in some ways, they were kind of sitting ducks after crossing the Jordan because they didn't have their camp set up. Like, they had all their children and livestock and stuff with them. They weren't really set up in formation to be able to fight if the armies of Jericho come out and decide to attack them. Plus, right after they cross, God tells Joshua to have all the men circumcised. So he puts them out of commission for probably a week or so. And they're sitting right in front of the city of Jericho. And it's not like they were walking into a nice church camp where they had, you know, nice shower houses and a commercial kitchen at their disposal. This was rough country. In fact, if you look at where Jericho was, it's actually one of the lowest points on earth. It's 750 feet below sea level. It's called the City of Palms, which is really interesting. It's kind of an oasis in the middle of a desert, really kind of a mountainous desert area. The area only receives a few inches of rain per year, and yet it's a very green area because of the springs. And the springs are in the middle of the city, and that's kind of why the city grew up around it. It was really the only way you could live in that area was because of those springs, and they were good fresh water springs. So it was great for growing food, raising livestock, but it was also a major target for raiders that would come through and just, you know, take out all the food from a settlement, which is why the city became fortified and, you know, the walls were built up. You can kind of see the little towers that are built into the wall. That would have been a place for guards to stand watch and defend the city if they needed to. And it's why the city has such massive walls. One of the graphics I looked at, I don't think it's really detailed on there, but It said that the outer wall would have been about 6 feet thick and 23 feet high. And then the inner wall was about 12 feet thick and 30 feet high. So it was kind of a slope up. And between there, we had they piled a bunch of dirt. So the base of the wall itself was protected, was actually underground in a sense. So what you see there would have only been at least the second wall. I think the first wall would have probably been mostly exposed. But the second wall would have been, you know, mostly protected by dirt. So if you went to set up a battering ram or started flinging stuff to try to bust the wall down, it's going to be hitting dirt, not the actual wall. The other thing that does is lets you hold out in a siege much longer. If an army decides to come in and trap everyone in the city, they could last a long time in there because they had food and they had water. And the walls and the towers would have made it really hard to actually get up close to the city to start with, because all you have to do is start throwing stuff down on the army, and they're going to have to back up. That was actually part of the protection. In fact, if you look at kind of ancient warfare, that was one of the main techniques. There's a saying in sports that says the best offense is a good defense, and that was kind of the strategy that they would have used. From 23 feet up, you can drop a rock and it's going to kill somebody, but they often resorted to other stuff too. There's accounts of throwing like tar, boiling tar down on armies that tried to take a city. And then also throwing fire yet down on top of them to try to light them and keep them away from the whole thing. You would have also had archers that could shoot arrows from up there. Anyway, all that to say, if the people of Jericho weren't going to come out to meet the Israelites to fight, this is going to be a long, tough battle. This was not going to be easy to try to capture the city. In fact, it would have probably been almost impossible with the way it was fortified. But fortunately, God doesn't seem too concerned about that, because in verse 2, he just straight up tells Joshua that the city will be given to him and that the king and the whole army is going to go away. So we have a promise. The question is, how is God going to do it? And we're so familiar with the whole story of, you know, marching around and what happens there, that we probably don't consider just how bad of a military strategy that was. We already looked at how fortified and how the defense was the walls itself. And if you want to conquer a fortified city, the worst thing you can do is just walk up to it, because you're going to get stuff thrown at you and you're going to get shot at. And there's not a whole lot you can do to shoot back, because it's just going to either hit the wall or go over the wall. Chances of you actually hitting the guys on top of the wall are very small, because they're in the towers or, you know, they're ducking down. So the idea of marching around the city and exposing yourself like that is probably about the worst thing you can do. We already looked at how they would have, you know, thrown stuff and used archers to shoot arrows at them. Now, we don't know if they tried that. It's possible that the Israelites stayed just out of reach of arrows if they were shooting that. Or it's possible that God made the people of Jericho so afraid they didn't even try to resist, and they were just actually marching right around the walls. But either way, even if that wasn't the case and they were all just huddled up inside the city, you have to think, if you were in the middle of that army marching around, the first day, it's like, yeah, we're gonna go out and do this thing. Looks a little scary, because what if they start shooting at us? But, you know, this is what God told us to do, so we're going to do this. Maybe the second day, you're still kind of there, but by the third, fourth, fifth, sixth day, you're like, man, I am sick of looking at my cousin's back of his head here. Like, what is going on? And yet, they kept doing it. They did exactly what God told them to do. I think it's easy to forget that probably wasn't easy. Like, there was probably some fear there. Probably the guys around you haven't showered in a while. It's probably not the greatest experience. But there's no indication that there was any complaining or deviation from the plan that God gave them. And that's actually pretty unusual. That's not the case with almost anything else that God asked the Israelites to do right after leaving Egypt. They're always complaining about something or trying to come up with a different plan. It seems like the 40 years that they spent in the wilderness finally got it through. Just do exactly what God tells you to do and things will go better for you. Obviously, with the exception of Achan, which we're not going to get into today, but there is still that reminder of one man bringing his disobedience, bringing judgment on the whole nation then. But of course, we know what happens next. God gives exact details to the Israelites. They follow it exactly. And the walls fall flat. I saw a video last week of a guy. He was banging with a sledgehammer on the base of a big concrete block silo. And, you know, it looks kind of fun. You're just knocking out some blocks, and all of a sudden, this thing just starts tipping right for him. This is huge. And he just drops that thing and runs. I mean, I think the guy that was videoing started yelling and carrying on. But it's not usual for a wall or anything to just fall flat. That's not how things work, unless you've got some well-planned explosives all around it. It's going to tip. And yet it says that the wall fell flat. It specifically says that it fell flat. So this was obviously not just there's been, you know, kind of skeptics that don't want to take the scriptures quite literally that try to explain it as like, well, the guys stomping around like created cracks in the wall, and maybe their shouting vibrated it so much that we're not talking something that can be moved by sound. This was a big deal, and obviously a work of God. And then the Israelites go up, and it specifically says that they were supposed to follow each other. How does that say that? Not seeing it here. Oh yeah, verse 20. Every man straight before him, they captured the city. So what I understood that to mean is like they were supposed to go single file into the city. In other words, this wasn't just a mad rush in, and it wasn't them like going to conquer the city. It was them just going and doing what God told them to do. And it would have also been interesting because if you see how that's positioned, there would have been no way to just walk into the city with the walls the way they were. There would have had to have been ramps created. So in the walls falling flat, it actually created those ramps on either side of that embankment so that they could just walk in. Anyway, all that made me curious. What is this pointing to aside from just a story? And I think when I saw it, it was like, why have I never thought of this connection? The first thing that I noticed is that there's so many sevens. And I know that seven is used over and over in Scripture, but why so many times here? There's 7 days, there's the seven priests, and there's the seven trumpets blowing seven times, you know, marching around the city 7 times on the 7th day. And it made me think a little bit, like, where else is there that many sevens in one place? And I thought of Revelations. So I started digging into it, and sure enough, there's just a pile of stuff that connects the two, where God is going to conquer the kingdom of this world and of darkness. And I'll just try to read you, I know we're running out of time here, but I'm going to try to read you just little snippets throughout Revelation and see if we can make that connection jump out a little bit more. If you want to turn to Revelation 5, I'm going to read 1 through 5. It says, "Then I saw on the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with 7 seals, and I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?' And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to give this to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." So this is the opening, or part of the opening scene in this really pretty crazy saga of Revelations. And if this were a story based in the Old Testament, this would be the part where God's giving the instructions of what's going to happen, how to do it. But in this case, there's not any human characters, or main characters at least. God is going to be the one doing the conquering here. So if we jump ahead to chapter 8, I'm going to read 1 through 9. Chapter 8, see if you can see some more sevens here. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, so before, between what we just read in chapter 5 and chapter 8 here, is Jesus opening those seven seals. And so we're jumping in on the last seal here, so we're at the seventh seal. It says, "When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Then I saw seven angels who stood before God, seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood. These were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. The second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed." And we could keep going there, but it's the rest of the trumpets there are what continues to happen. Jump ahead to chapter 11, Revelations 11, and then 15 through 19. This is the seventh trumpet, so we looked at the first two there, and all the rest of this between 8 and 11 is what's going to happen with the rest of the trumpets, which is all on the seventh seal. And we're going to look at the seventh trumpet now on the seventh seal. It says, "Then the seventh angel blew his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, 'The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever.' And the 24 elders who sit on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, 'We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, who is and who was, for you have taken your great power and begun to reign. The nations raged, but your wrath came, and the time for the dead to be judged, and for rewarding your saints, the prophets and saints, and those who fear your name, both great and small, and for destroying the destroyers of the earth.' Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the ark of his covenant was seen within his temple. There were flashes of lightnings, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail." Now, I think it's kind of amazing that just like the Israelites, we're told exactly what's going to happen when God conquers. We're told exactly how it's going to happen. And when God conquers the kingdom of darkness of this world once and for all and returns it to the way it was supposed to be originally, we don't have to wonder really how it's going to happen in a sense. Now, there's going to be details that obviously we don't understand, and we're not going to fully understand until we see it. But it's given to us in great detail. And God made that promise, and he's going to do it. There's never been a time where he made a promise to the Israelites and never actually accomplished it. The question is whether we actually believe it enough to hold out to the end if it happens in our lifetimes. There's a few more verses in Revelations 18 I wanted to read before we kind of jump back to the account there in Joshua. It's chapter 18, 1 and 2. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory, and he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast." I don't think it's by accident that it uses that language, fallen. Babylon has fallen. Babylon is representing, I think it may actually be a physical city when that time comes, but it represents all of the kingdoms of this world. It's kind of the center of darkness, wickedness, wealth, prosperity, all the things that go with what Satan offers. When that falls, it's a representation of the fall of all of that. Just like the fall of the walls of Jericho represented the fall of Canaan and the conquering of it by the Israelites and by God. It's obvious that there's going to be all these things taking place, and I think that the things we see in Jericho that happened around Jericho, the marching around it, the trumpets, all that points forward to this account in Revelations. And I just love that kind of stuff. I think it's amazing where there's connections like that. It doesn't change the meaning necessarily of the story or of what God was teaching the Israelites through it, or what, you know, the fact that he needed to bring judgment there. It just makes it deeper, I think. Because it's a literal thing that happened. And we're looking forward to another thing where God will do the same thing, but in a much, much greater way. And what's interesting is that the Israelites didn't really have anything to do with it. Yes, they followed God and obeyed him, and we'll look at that a little bit in terms of our lesson in all of this, but they didn't shake down those walls. They really had nothing to do with it. It was still God that did the work. And just like the same thing is going to happen in Revelations. When we come to that time, God is going to be doing the one judging. It's not our place. We may get to see it, we might not. But we can trust the fact that he has promised that he will do it and that his kingdom will win in the end. There's a verse in Hebrews 11, it's verse 30. It says, By faith the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. That made me wonder a little bit, like, so we know that God did the work, but was faith some kind of power that knocked down the wall that only the Israelites had? And I think that is a big lesson in this whole thing. Faith played a major role in it. And I know we've looked at this in other accounts, like the crossing of the Jordan, but what exactly is faith? And what role did the Israelites and their faith have in this story? Well, I don't think that verse in Hebrews there is saying that faith is some kind of power that can do things. Faith depends on the object in whom the faith is placed. I'll just say that again. Faith depends on the object in whom the faith is placed. When you put your faith in God, you do not become a God. I think sometimes we get that mixed up. Never forget that faith is much more about obedience than it is about believing we have some supernatural power to perform miracles. God may choose to work through us and do miracles even sometimes, but it's not because we believed or had enough faith to get that power and then do it ourselves. It's always God choosing to work. And faith is simply an obedience to that he gives us. And even that in itself is a miracle, that God puts that inside us to even believe enough in him to see him work like that. So I think ultimately the lesson in this is, for us, is about obedience. In one sense, the Israelites, like I already said, really didn't have anything to do with this in terms of the walls falling down, and yet they had everything to do with it because God wanted to work through them to do this thing. He chose to work through them. And so if they would have disobeyed, I think God would have still accomplished his goals at some point, but it may have meant another, you know, 40 years doing something else for a while, the fact that they just obeyed what God asked them to do immediately meant that his will was accomplished immediately. And so I think that's part of the lesson for us. It took a faith on their part to believe that God would do that. So faith was a part of it, but that faith doesn't mean anything if you're not actually going to obey and do what God tells you to do, because that means that you don't actually have the faith to start with. They didn't have the power to make the miracle happen, but they did have the willingness to be obedient. And I think you could argue that the greatest victory in this whole story is actually that the Israelites obeyed God. God can do crazy, amazing things. Obviously, we know that he created the world. He can destroy it if he wants to. But the fact that he worked in the Israelites to the point where they just obeyed him is one of the greatest miracles in this whole story, I think. And when it comes to, you know, looking forward to the account there in Revelations about conquering the world that Jesus will sometime do in the future, we aren't really given a lot of instructions on what exactly we're supposed to do during that time. We're not told to go, like, when you see this sign, then go conquer Jerusalem so that God can come back and reign there. Really the only instructions, and correct me if you think of other examples, but when Jesus was giving details to the disciples when he was about to leave, basically what he tells them when they're asking him, like, what do we do when the end comes, he basically tells them to just watch, keep a watchful eye, and just be ready, along with maybe running for the hills, which, I don't know, maybe that could apply to what we're going to be facing at some point. It definitely applied to what happened right after Jesus left when Jerusalem was destroyed. The people that listened to what Jesus said about running for the hills were the ones that actually lived. The ones who stayed in the city were the ones that ended up getting killed. I don't know if that applies, will apply to us too if we live during that time of Jesus' return. But for the most part, we're not given instructions on what we're supposed to do. But Jesus did have a number of things for us to do before he comes back, before that time comes. I'll just run through a couple of them. He said to repent and follow him. He told us to rejoice even when we're persecuted. He told us to let our light shine. He told us to reconcile with our brother quickly when things come up and to love our enemies. He told us to lay up treasures in heaven and to forgive others. And he told us to make more disciples. I was listening to a sermon by a guy named Steve Gentry. He's a pastor in North Chesterfield, Virginia. And he was talking about this story, and a quote that kind of stuck out to me that he said, grace and obedience are not opposites. Without obedience, God is not pleased with your life. And I think that's good to remember. You know, because of what Jesus did for us on the cross, we're not immediately punished when we choose to disobey God or walk away or start complaining or do the opposite of what God asks us to. Like, you know, often the Israelites were pretty severely punished right away when they did that. But we get to live with the Holy Spirit and the grace of God to gently pull us back when we wander off and we want to go do our own thing. But grace is not a replacement for obedience to the commands that Jesus gave us. He is still our King, and one day he will judge the world. That's kind of a terrifying thought, really. If we're not walking with God where he wants us to be, that's pretty terrifying to think about every one of my deeds being judged before a God that has that much power. Yet on the other hand, if we are walking with God, it says that he will use that time to reward and to recognize the things that we did for his kingdom. You saw someone that needed food and clothes and you gave them food and clothes. It's like you did it to me. But I think in a sense, he will choose to look at the acts of good that we did in his kingdom and choose to not look at the evil things that I did because of what Jesus did for us. But if we are not on his side, it goes the other way. And that's terrifying, yet also very encouraging. If we're walking with God, those good things that we do in service of God's kingdom won't go unnoticed by him. I guess just in closing here, there's a kingdom that's going to be conquered and a kingdom that will do the conquering. And we get to choose which one we want to be part of. On the one side, we have a king that has never been wrong when he promised something. He's never gone back on that promise, and he's promised to conquer this other kingdom. And we already know who's going to win. So let's obey the king who can make giant rock walls fall down flat and will someday bring an entire world to its knees. I want to be on the side of that king, not the kingdom that's going to be conquered. Why don't we just stand and we'll close with prayer here and you can be dismissed.